I guess the title should really be Spin Phone Model Singular, because I'm only really going to talk about one of them. So really I'm reporting on some joint work with four other people, so Richard Dowdall, Winston Fairbairn, Enrico Gomes, and Frank Hellman. The paper's on the archive, and so there's version 2s up you can get on the actual archive server, probably not on the mirrors yet. Okay, so a bit of history about the model I'm going to talk about. It's modelled as a lot of models in quantum gravity are modelled on the Pontano-Reggie model, which goes all the way back to 1968, and is a model of three-dimensional quantum gravity. And we understand a lot of things about the model, perhaps not everything yet. But a lot of things about the Pontano-Reggie model. And in many ways, what a lot of people are trying to do in quantum gravity is
John?
What happens in three dimensions. Hello.
John?
Hello.
John, I'm sorry. If you can speak louder and as possible, clear as you can, we'll appreciate. The sound system is very bad here. Thanks.
Okay. You're very clear. Is that good enough?
Yeah, that's better. Thank you. Hello. Thank you.
Yeah, but then you guys know. Okay. Let me see. Is that better? Does that make much difference? I can't hear anybody.
Yeah, that's better. Sorry, I have to plug in and plug out the sound. Yes, that's better. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll try it like that. Okay, yeah. All right, so that's the Pontano-Reggie model. And the next piece of history is Witten's work on three-dimensional quantum gravity in 1989, where he talked about the functional integral of Chern-Simons type variety, and showed rather spectacularly that this does indeed give you the same model of quantum gravity that the Pontano-Reggie model gives you. And indeed, that provided a huge boost to work on the Pontano-Reggie model, which had gone a bit slowly until then, because it then had this completely alternative physical setting of the same theory, but in functional integral setting. Around the same time, a lot of things happened around that time. But the first four-dimensional model, analogous to the Pontano-Reggie model, was written soon afterwards by Oguri. This is the BF theory, which generalizes to any dimension. And Oguri particularly wrote the four-dimensional version. And interestingly, also, I guess, pushed off the ball on four-dimensional group field theories in the same paper. So Lewis Crane and I knew about this stuff, and we were particularly interested in turning this 4D BF theory into quantum gravity. We put forward our model in 1996, which was modeled on the functional integral for quantum gravity, which you can write as a BF theory, but with some extra constraints. And we worked sort of in an analogous fashion to try and implement these constraints, thinking along the lines of the three-dimensional model, which actually doesn't need that sort of constraint, trying to make a four-dimensional analog of the three-dimensional quantum gravity model given by the Pontano-Reggie model and the way it relates to Witten's functional integral. Well, so that model provoked a lot of work, I mean, more than we anticipated at the time, I think. And I've put a couple of question marks against it because although there are some good properties of that model, there's lots of other things that leave something to be desired. And we still don't really know what the relation between that model and quantum gravity actually is. I think it's fair to say that if you think about the asymptotic regime, we don't know any obvious way in which our 1996 model is four-dimensional quantum gravity. On the other hand, we don't actually know for certain that it isn't. And the reason is the asymptotics are rather difficult to get your hands on. But it turns out that the sort of obvious ways in which it ought to be quantum gravity in a sort of very local sense don't seem to work. And particularly some more recent work of Emanuela Oleski shows that. I don't think it's quite clear yet that it actually doesn't work at all. So to come on to the models I'm going to talk about today, it's the final line, the gamma line, the models with a Mirtzi parameter. So the extra ingredient is adding the Mirtzi parameter in, which was absent in the old model. And the way in which it's added in also affects the way in which you view the state space on a three-dimensional hypersurface. And the model for this is the quantum tetrahedron of Barbieri, which was first proposed in 1997. And it turns out that if you pursue this idea and glue it into the old model in the right sort of way, then you get all these new models, which, due to all these names on the last row, EPR, the first three authors, I guess, started the ball rolling, and then added Levine in a paper which gives most precisely the model which I'm going to talk about. Rudell and Krasnov developed very similar models around the same time. So these models are all very similar.
Comment from Warsaw. May I interrupt?
Yeah.
So the Barbieri tetrahedron is just an example of the quantum geometry. So I think that quantum geometry could be listed somewhere between Oguri and, somewhere there.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So this is really a spin foam history, but yes. The other thing to mention is a lot of this has a lot of parallels with work in loop quantum gravity. And I think in the old models there were parallels, but there's very much closer analog between the new model and constructions of loop quantum gravity. And I hope that will become evident as I talk, as I go through. But certainly the addition of the Mirtzi parameter is one of the big things that was missing in this analogy. So I guess that's right. So the analogy with quantum geometry of the loop quantum gravity type is that now actually much closer. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. So this is basically what is a spin foam model. So we start with a triangulated manifold. So this is basically just a convenient way of dicing a complicated manifold up into lots of small pieces. And triangulation is just a very simple way of doing it. You can actually do these sorts of constructions in other ways of cutting things up. But let's stick with this triangulation. So typically what you do is the state sum model has some data on all the various simplexes in this triangulation. And the types of model I'm going to talk about, you have the representation of something is the labels on the two-dimensional simplexes, but the set of which is called delta 2 in equation 1. And when you're given four representations around four triangles, then a tetrahedron has those four as its faces, and on the tetrahedron the data is an intertwiner between the tensor product of those representations and the trivial representation. So this is labeling data for your state sum model, and z of t is a partition function, so it's like statistical mechanics. You sum over all possible labelings of this data with some weight factors, which in statistical mechanics would be Boltzmann weights, but here they're just arbitrary functions called F2, F3, and F4. So F2 is the weight factor on a two-simplex. It's just a function of the single label row, which is on a two-simplex, the representation. F3 is a function of all the data on the three-dimensional simplex. So it's a function of the four representations on the four faces and the one intertwiner on that three-simplex tetrahedron. And F4 is a more complicated thing. It's a function of all the labels around its boundary, all five tetrahedron labels. So the notation is a little bit short here, all five intertwiners and all 10 representations in the boundary. Okay, so those are the local weights. And we're particularly interested in F4. That's the most complicated gadget. And that's the thing I'm going to concentrate on today. But essentially, I mean, you can assign arbitrary weights, F2, F3, and F4, and then you can ask what the model you've got, and is it going to do with gravity, and so on. Now, of course, I'm not going to say too much about philosophy here, what we're doing, but this is, you can think of this as perhaps a little analogous to doing lattice gauge theory or something. You pick some fairly arbitrary weight factors, and then when you do lattice gauge theory, you have to do a whole lot of hocus-pocus with a renormalization group and so on, and in the end you hope some physical theory comes out of it. Well, this isn't quite the same, because here we're not actually talking about a sort of fixed lattice in space-time, because the space-time structure is varying. So there is actually a sort of fundamental difference between what we're doing and what you do in the lattice gauge theory. So here you have a coherent superposition of different space-times on this lattice, if you like, think of it as a lattice, and that's not the same as just having a fixed lattice and doing quantum theory on it, lattice gauge theory, but it is sort of similar spirit. I think that's all I'm going to say about philosophy. I just want to say more that this is a technology-driven talk rather than a philosophy-driven talk, as it were. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. So this is the quantum tetrahedron. Now it's all gone very quiet. Is anybody actually on the other end of the line somewhere?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so the quantum tetrahedron. So now we're thinking, this is a three-dimensional gadget, obviously. So we're thinking in terms of a three-dimensional hypersurface in some space-time. So expect some state space of quantum states. And here the picture is somewhat similar to the one I just described, but specialised to a particular case where the labels on the triangles are spins. That's to say they're non-negative half integers, 0, a half, 1, and so on, which label the irreducible representations of SU2. And then on the tetrahedron itself, you have an intertwiner between four representations on its faces. So this green tetrahedron here, you have K1, K2, K3, and K4, being four representations. And then this rather monstrous gadget, HOM of C to the tensor product of all four, simply picks out the SU2 invariant subspace of the tensor product of those four representations. So this is an intertwining. You can think of it as an intertwining map from any subset of the representations on the faces to the remaining representation, if you like. Now this thing is an SU2 invariant gadget, so it's has very much the symmetries of three-dimensional space, or three-dimensional quantum tetrahedron. It's worth noting that there's four physical parameters here, the four Ks. And they have the physical interpretation of being an area. We think of this as a, in terms of classical mechanics, as a tetrahedron where four of the area parameters are specified. But of course, in the geometry of a tetrahedron, classically, there's six parameters. There's two remaining parameters which fluctuate. So the quantum state space is you can think of as functions on some quantization of the remaining phase space, which is a two-dimensional phase space. So the remaining two parameters, the remaining geometrical parameters, should be non-commuting variables in the quantum theory. So this quantum tetrahedron, you can think of this space of intertwiners very much in that way, and you have operators which correspond to those remaining measurements.
I just wanted to clarify the notation you're using in 2.
Sure. What's the question?
You wanted you to clarify the notation.
This intertwiner is a homomorphism from what do the K and the I label again?
So C is the trivial representation, so it's a homomorphism from C to the tensor product of four representations of SU2. So VK1, tensor VK2, tensor VK3, tensor VK4.
Okay, thanks, John.
Okay, so let's move on to the next transparency. And now we come to the specifics of the EPRL model. Now, in the EPRL model, the group we're concerned with is actually spin 4. Spin 4 is the spin group in four-dimensional Euclidean space, is SU2 cross SU2. So its irreducible representations have two labels, J minus and J plus. So that's the labeling set on a two-dimensional simplex. Then the intertwiners is this gadget on the right of equation 3 here. This is the homomorphisms in spin 4 from the trivial C to V, the tensor product of four factors V, J minus, J plus. That's four representation spaces, irreducible representation spaces of spin 4. And the intertwiners we're interested in are the ones in the image of this map phi. So phi maps the SU2 intertwiners into the spin 4 intertwiners. and so the notation is that I hat, one of the SU2 intertwiners of the previous slide, is mapped to an I, which is the spin 4 intertwiner of interest. Moreover, we do another very special thing. The J plus and J minus representations aren't any old representations, but they're related to the KI parameters in a very particular way. This is where the Amirtzi parameter gamma comes in. But the equation 4 tells you that J plus is a half 1 plus gamma times K, and J minus is a half 1 minus gamma times K. And this is the big difference between these models and the old models. In the old models, we had J plus and J minus equal, and there was no room for a gamma parameter. And now we sort of unbalanced it between the self-dual and the anti-self-dual side of the model. Okay, so I need to explain what this map is, how we turn an SU2 intertwiner, a quantum tetrahedron in three dimensions, if you like, into some sort of quantum tetrahedron in four dimensions. That's the spin 4 intertwiner. And that's done on the next slide. So moving on to the intertwiner diagram.
Okay, John, before you go to the next slide,
yeah.
I think people here would like to know about gamma a little bit more. Is J half integer and K also half integer?
Yeah, so in this Euclidean model, everything has to be half integer. So in fact, the values of gamma is somewhat restricted. You have to make gamma be a rational number such that, and you have to make the Ks be some multiple of one half, such that everything in that equation ends up being half integer.
Okay.
So you make gamma P over Q and restrict K to be a multiple of Q, or possibly Q over 2, but it all works out right.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. So, so now explaining the intertwiner diagram, I'll just explain the strategy a bit. So actually, before I move on to the next slide, back onto equation 3, what the strategy is you take your intertwiner on the left-hand side, the I hat, and you sort of basically do whatever you like to it to map into the tensor product of the four Vs on the right-hand side of equation 3 there. And then, when you're done, you integrate over the group at spin 4 to make it sit in the intertwining operators, the invariant subspace of the tensor product of those four spin 4 representations. So now moving on to the next slide, we've got the intertwiner diagram there. And this diagram goes from, you read from right to left. You start with the SU2 intertwiner I hat, which you sort of chop the diagram vertically with a line. If you chop through the Ks with a line, you see what space it lives in. It lives in K1 tensor K2. Tensor K3, tensor K4. And then the next thing that happens, moving the line to the left, is the vertices that split you, the Ks up into J1 tensor J1 plus, tensor J1 minus, and so on for the others. I haven't written them all in. And this three-way vertex is just a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient in SU2. That's what the meeting of the three green lines means. And so in that way, I hat becomes an SU2 invariant object in J1 plus tensor J1 minus tensor J2 plus tensor J2 minus and so on all the way up to tensor J4 minus. And finally, we act with an element of spin 4. Remember, spin 4 is SU2 cross SU2, so we act with an element x plus and x minus, one in each group. And we integrate over the whole of those possibilities in spin 4, so we integrate over x plus and x minus, and that gives us a spin 4 invariant object, and that is the EPRL intertwining object I, which is used in the model. Okay, I'm just having a pause here. So, any question about this construction? Well, one thing I should mention is that those restrictions on the emergency parameter of the previous slide mean that the way in which the K injects into J plus tensor J minus is it's either the highest SU2 subspace in the Clebsch-Gordan product of J1, of J plus tensor J minus, or it's the lowest factor in the Clebsch-Gordan decomposition. And this seems to this property seems to result in a lot of the nice properties of the construction. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide. And this is the standard way in which we make a four simplex amplitude in spin foam models. So this rather deceptively simple diagram tells you, given five spin 4 tensors, that each I1 to I5, each I is in the tensor product of four, the product of four factors of spin 4. And I've written just one of the representation labels on the edge, on the 2-3 edge. That representation label is J minus 2-3 and J plus 2-3. And I haven't written the other 10 in because it would just make a mess. There's 10 different representations of spin 4 in this diagram. And basically, you just connect all these tensors together to make a scalar. So this whole diagram here just represents a single complex number, and that's the amplitude of the four simplex. It's a little bit tricky because you have to know exactly which inner product to use to connect all these things together. And it turns out the right thing to use is the so-called epsilon inner product, or the one that's generated on spin half representations by the epsilon tensor, the two-dimensional epsilon tensor. You have to use that as the right inner product. So there's a little bit of trickiness in the diagrams, but once you understand this spin networkology, then the definition is just straightforward coupling of tensors together. Okay, so this slide, lots of things are hidden, of course. In each vertex here is hidden the whole of the complicated mess of the previous slide. So you should go back a slide, pick up the whole of that diagram there with the integral over x plus and x minus and all the complicated stuff, and insert that picture in every vertex on the four simplex amplitude. So it really is quite a complicated gadget.
John, could you say just a couple of remarks about what the other choices of contractions are and why they're not right? I mean, the one that you said is the most natural one.
Well, basically, so this diagram I've drawn as a sort of simple fashion, but you could draw it in many different ways on the page. You could draw the diagram different ways up and have different permutations of all the objects, and you could draw the lines between them winding around the diagram in different ways. And you want to make sure all of these actually give the same answer. So the spin network calculus is very cleverly constructed so that you can push around the diagram, you can sort of deform the diagram, and however you draw the diagram, when you connect all the tensors up according to the recipe, you always get the same number. So the whole thing has very nice symmetries in sort of PVT everything, and pushing all the mats around. And if you just sort of pick any old inner product out of the hat, then usually it doesn't have those properties, and then you end up in a mess.
Okay. Thank you.
You might try and use the unitary inner product, for example, but you were getting all sorts of messes if you tried that. You'd have to put complex conjugations around the place, and you would find it would depend on which way around you drew the diagram, and you'd never... In fact, the early history of spin networks is bedeviled with this sort of problem. If you go back to the early literature on Clebsch-Gordan coefficients and try and read it, you'll find it's completely unreadable because people didn't understand that there was a diagrammatic way of understanding all the various sign factors and normalization coefficients. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. Now we can state our asymptotic problem. So we're interested in recovering classical mechanics, essentially. So we take our quantum amplitudes and we rescale them to larger and larger values, hoping that we'll end up in a sort of classical regime. And it's obvious what to do with the k's. We simply scale the k's with some positive integer lambda and make lambda bigger and bigger. But it's not at all clear what to do with the i's, the i1 to i5 on the previous slide. Because you see, the problem is they're intertwining operators in spaces which depend on k. And as you make the k's bigger, these vector spaces of intertwining operators get bigger and bigger. So you actually end up running through different spaces. So you sort of want to say, well, I'm going to make the i's bigger in some sense. But what does it mean to have something varying when the spaces it lives in are varying at the same time and getting bigger? So that's your sort of central problem in posing the asymptotics. And of course, we didn't have this problem 10 years ago because the model 10 years ago was rather simple, that the intertwining operators were unique in the old model. And so we had no problem in saying what they meant. We just picked the unique one at every stage. There's no freedom. Okay, so this is where we depart from the old stuff. There's a new problem to solve here. So moving on to the next slide, just going to say a little bit about coherent states. So the solution to this problem is to think about coherent states. So you can define coherent states in group representation theory, and they have sort of similar properties to the familiar coherent states in quantum mechanics. So we think of the sort of the Gaussian coherent state. Well, turns out what you do for SU2 is if we have a spin k representation of SU2, then we have the coherent state for every unit vector, every direction vector n. So that you think of n as in S2, or it's a unit vector in three-dimensional space. So and it's basically a coherent state for this vector is one which has the maximum possible spin in that direction. So L, the Boltace L, are the three standard generators of the SU2 Lie algebra. So L dot n is the Lie algebra generator in the n direction. You think of making that the z direction temporarily or something. And the state alpha has eigenvalue ik, so that's the maximum possible value for the spin k representation. And the Lie algebra elements are anti-Hermitian here, that's why there's a factor of I. Well, more transparent notation perhaps for these vectors alpha is written in equation 7 here, the Bra-Ket notation, which I'll use a bit. So in the ket here we have k, the representation label, n the direction, and then theta is a reminder that, of course, there's a freedom in the choice of phase for coherent state. If you have a coherent state for a given direction n, then you can multiply by e to the I theta, where theta is an arbitrary phase parameter, and you get another coherent state for the same direction. Okay. Now, these states have similar properties to the familiar coherent states in quantum mechanics. In particular, they sort of minimize the uncertainty. If you look at the uncertainty in the three different spin generators, LX, LY, and LZ, then these coherent states minimize the sum of those three uncertainties. Okay, so I'll move to the next slide. So the key to talking about the scaling of the intertwiners when we do the asymptotics is to look at the coherent intertwiners. So these are intertwiners based on coherent states. This idea was introduced by Levine and Speciale. And the basic idea is in equation 8. I'll try and explain equation 8 here. So on the right-hand side of equation 8, we have four coherent states. So remember, the intertwining operator is an invariant object in a tensor product of four SE2 spins. So we select four coherent state vectors on the right of equation 8 there, labeled with K1, N1, theta1, all the way up to K4, N4, theta4. We tensor these together, and then we want to act on the whole thing by H, an element of SU2. So that just means H acts on each coherent state simultaneously. And then we integrate over all possible H's in SU2 to get an invariant object in SU2. So the integral over H projects us down into the space of intertwiners. So in this way, we have an intertwiner determined...
John?
Hello.
Question from Marseille. The left-hand side of equation 8 still depend on the angles, thetas?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Okay, so you said you just not written the notation, but it's still dependent.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so on the right, you input four phases, theta 1 to theta 4, and of course, there'll be one overall undetermined phase in this intertwiner you get. Which, yeah, you're right. Carla's quite right. It doesn't appear in the notation on the left-hand side. So what you get here in this way is a particular state for the quantum tetrahedron, which is determined by giving these four vectors, unit vectors, N1, N2, N3, and N4, up to rotation. Of course, because we've selected a rotation invariant state, I simultaneously rotate N1, N2, N3, and N4 with a SO3 rotation, of course I will end up with the same quantum state. Now there's this big result in the mathematical literature from 1980 or so by Guillemin and Sternberg called quantization commutes and reduction. And it turns out that this is one of the few cases where they're quantizing first and reducing the system to the invariant state commutes with doing it classically, in other words, going to the reduced phase space and then quantizing. So the theorem is that the vector space of states, the Hilbert space, as a vector space is isomorphic if you do it one way or the other way. So what this means for us, since what I did in equation 8 was I quantized first and then I reduced to the invariant subspace, it means we can actually do it the other way around. And we can start with the classical reduced phase space and then just quantize on that. And the classical reduced phase space amounts to considering these coherent tetrahedra when you have this so-called closure condition, number 9, which is that the vectors N1, N2, N3, and N4 sum to zero in a sort of parallelepiped with their lengths given by K1, K2, K3, and K4. You can think of this as the sort of charge conservation condition, which tells you that SU2 is a symmetry. There's a rather better picture for this, which is the little tetrahedron drawn in the diagram there, which is that this is exactly the relation between the normal vectors, the face normal vectors of a Euclidean tetrahedron, if the areas are given by the numbers K1, K2, K3, and K4. This is the unique constraint amongst those four unit phase vectors. So taking in mind the fact that we have this rotational symmetry in the quantum state, we see that the quantum state 8 is built out of specifying a Euclidean tetrahedron here, as in the diagram, that picture there. Those four vectors specify that Euclidean tetrahedron uniquely, but up to rotation. Because of the rotational invariance built into an equation 8, it's essentially the geometry is this tetrahedron drawn in the diagram, plus together with all of the tetrahedra gotten by rotating that with an SO3 rotation. And of course, the information then isn't a single tetrahedron. After you've done the SO3 rotation, what's left of that information is the metric on the tetrahedron. The metric is SO3 invariant, of course. And because it's SO3 and not O3, you've also got the information in the orientation of the tetrahedron. Turns out to be quite important. So you can think of this coherent tetrahedron as specified by a metric on a tetrahedron together with an orientation.
John?
Yeah.
You, a couple of times you said that the state is completely given by these four ends. But as Carlo and you both told us, there are also these orientation angles, theta, right? So in other words, if you give me an intertwiner, I know how to construct the tetrahedron, but the converse seems not to be the case. Right?
Yeah, that's right, yes. So you're quite right, Abhay, that more precisely, you have a one-dimensional space of states specified by this metric and orientation. So it doesn't tell you the phase. That's absolutely right. The phase of the state is undetermined.
Thank you.
Now, we would like to say the converse, that given the quantum state, we can recover the geometry back. And that seems to be more or less the idea. Certainly in the asymptotic regime, when the k's are large, then that's correct, that it goes both ways. And if you're given the state, you can then reconstruct the geometry of this tetrahedron, the metric and its orientation. Of course, there is some sort of quantum uncertainty, so at small values of k, this wouldn't necessarily be exactly true. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. I want to now boot this construction up to considering a whole closed three manifold. So I'm thinking of a sort of a hypersurface in space-time, which is something like an initial value surface or something, very much like the surface you would consider in loop quantum gravity, say, looking at the space of state. And then the idea is that on this closed three manifold, you have the spin label k on each triangle and an intertwining operator on each tetrahedron. And so we can simply form the tensor product of all the intertwining operators, one for each tetrahedron. And that's what's done in equation 10. That gives us a boundary state for this closed three manifold, depending on a choice of k for each triangle and a choice of intertwining operator on each tetrahedron. And of course, the intertwining operators, as I just explained, can be specified by giving these four vectors, n1, n2, n3, and n4, on each tetrahedron. Now, in the little picture, you see that the k is common. You have two tetrahedra. I'm supposed to be drawing here two tetrahedra which are glued together in the three manifold sigma. Those two faces that with arrows pointing to them are the same face by the time you've glued it up in sigma. And so the value of k is the same on each. But nothing so far restricts the intertwiners. The intertwining operators are unrelated, except, of course, that the value of k is common to the pair of them. But the four vectors, n1, n2, and n3, and n4, on the left-hand tetrahedron, have nothing to do with n1, n2, n3, and n4 prime, say, on the right-hand tetrahedron there. So what we have here is what you might call an area geometry. See, these k's specify the areas, and they sort of glue up nicely. So there's well-defined areas of all two-dimensional surfaces in this geometry. But the geometry of the tetrahedra as metrics don't necessarily glue up properly. So nothing I've said so far would tell you that the metric geometries glue up. So when you glue those two triangles together, there are three parameters for the metric of a triangle, the three lengths of the edges, but only one of those three parameters has been programmed in to match. That's the area. And there's two other moduli which could mismatch. So that's what an area geometry is. So we see here in general that the quantum state specified by this boundary data is sort of the classical data of the spin labels k on each triangle and the n vectors, 4 for each tetrahedron. That sort of boundary data, the area geometry, specifies you the state psi, that's the red arrow going left to right. And then going backwards, we expect that when k's are large, of course the quantum state will give you back the classical geometry, the k's and the n, the area geometry.
So okay. In this construction, why, I mean, supposing that face that you are identified is the K4, is the fourth face on each tetrahedron, the prime and the unprime tetrahedron.
Supposing it's K4 in both, yes.
Yeah, both, K4 and K4, yeah, is equal to K4. So, but as you pointed out, N4 and N4 prime are unrelated.
Correct, yes.
So, what would happen if one actually asked that they be the same also?
Well,
why don't we ask that?
Yes, you might try and force them to be the same. In fact, we're going to do that in a minute, but not exactly the same, because of course you want to put in some sort of parallel transport. So as one is the other one parallel transported somehow.
Right.
You don't want exactly the same, otherwise the whole thing was sort of fixed and have some to be Euclidean geometry for the whole thing if you're not careful.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So let's move on and see how we can make this more geometrical. So let's move to the next slide. So now I want to explain a subset of states called which we call the Regi states. I'm not quite sure if that's commonly used already, but we certainly called it that. And these are a subset of the boundary states which I just explained on the previous slide. So in the Regi states, if we just look at the classical geometry for a minute, we insist not on an area geometry, as I've previously explained, but on a Regi geometry. Now, a Regi geometry is when each tetrahedron has its own little Euclidean geometry, but they match up. So when you glue them together, they form a nice Regi calculus geometry on the whole three manifold. So so in a Regi geometry, you have an edge length for each of those blue edges for each tetrahedron, and I've drawn here G, a red G in an arrow. The G is a rotation which identifies the triangle on the right there, the blue triangle on the right, with the blue triangle on the left there by an actual rotation, and that involves matching up three parameters of the geometry. From right to left. So the Regi geometries are a subset of area geometries. Of course, the areas match if you insist all the edge lengths match, the areas match too. But they're more special than that. There are two other parameters for every face that match as well. So the Regi geometries are a very, very special subset of the area geometries. Now it turns out. But for these Regi geometries, there's a canonical choice of phase for the quantum state on the whole three manifold. That's a very important canonical choice. So it turns out that for a given tetrahedron, there isn't really any canonical choice of phase. But when you glue them all together in this Regi-like way, there is a nice canonical choice for the whole three manifold, not for any part of it, but for the whole thing as a whole. And the second important thing, so I'll explain that in a minute, but the second important thing, the reason why we're interested in these Regi states, I mean, they look very sort of special in particular, but our main conjecture in the quantum models is that these Reggie states dominate the models. So although that, yes, they're very special states, it appears that they play a dominating role when you look at the asymptotics. This came out already, this was first seen in some work by Friedel and Conradi last summer. They reported in the conference here. When they looked at a four-manifold as a whole, they looked at the states and model you get by gluing together a model very much like the one I'm talking about, and then looking at the asymptotics on the whole four-manifold. And they saw some sort of condition like this domination of the Reggie state. In the work I'm talking about today, we see this at the level of a single force impact. We can see that there's this comes out in the asymptotics of a single force impact. So I'm sort of hopeful that this will turn out to be a generic feature of these models, and that when we understand this better, this will be the key to understanding the quantum geometry.
A question,
yes.
What is alpha?
Ah, so alpha is a coherent state. So if you go back about three slides to the coherent state slide, that was my notation for my very compact notation for a coherent state. So I now need to explain a bit about alpha in this picture. So remember that each intertwiner is built from four coherent states. You tensor together four coherent states, and then you integrate over SU2 to make it rotationally invariant. So in the diagram there, the left-hand tetrahedron is the B tetrahedron, and the right-hand tetrahedron is the A tetrahedron. So the left-hand face, which is to be glued up, is the face of tetrahedron B, which is going to be glued to tetrahedron A. So that's face BA. There's a particular coherent state in that called alpha BA. That's one of the four for left-hand tetrahedron. And then on the right-hand tetrahedron, there's alpha AB. It's the coherent state for tetrahedron A on the face B. The face is going to be glued to B. So when you tensor together all of the intertwiners for all the tetrahedra in this boundary three manifold, in particular, you have both alpha BA and alpha AB all tensored together. Now, the point is, the canonical choice of phase is to correlate the phase of the coherent state alpha BA with the phase of the coherent state alpha AB. So you can pick one of them completely arbitrarily, but then the construction determines for you a canonical choice of phase for the other one. And that canonical choice of phase is given in equation 11. So let me explain equation 11. We start with alpha AB, that's the coherent state on the right, and we act with J. Well, J is the standard antilinear map for SU2. It's the you complex conjugate the components of the state, and then you multiply by the two-dimensional epsilon tensor, you know, the one with components 0, 1, minus 1, 0. Now that operation is an SU2 invariant operation, the rather weird antilinear operation that gives SU2 all its funny properties. and then what you do is you act by the SU2 element, which affects the gluing up of the two tetrahedra. So recall that when you have a quantum tetrahedron, you can realize it by four unit vectors, n1, n2, n3, and n4. So there's four of those on the left-hand side, and there's four others, n1 prime up to n4 prime, on the right-hand side. And they specify these tetrahedral geometries in Euclidean space exactly. And then G is the rotational group element, which exactly picks up, if you like, one tetrahedron and glues it onto the other one. So that specifies a three-dimensional rotation exactly. In fact, I'm going to talk of G as if it's in SU2. So there's some long and complicated story about how to lift that up to the spin group, which I won't bother you with now. That will be a long discussion. But just so think of G as a rotation, but it's actually in SU2. The point is, it's determined uniquely by these geometries, and by therefore by the coherent state. So we have this phase coherence construction.
John?
Yes, Carlo.
What is the relation between this J just flipping the direction of the N?
Ah, very good. If you have a coherent state which belongs to direction N, then when you act with J on it, it's a coherent state that belongs to the direction minus N.
Right, okay. So I could think it this way.
Yes, and so that's exactly what you want, because the coherent state belongs to the outward point of normal vector on one tetrahedron, and you want it to be matched with the coherent state with the normal points in the opposite direction after you've acted with the G.
Thanks.
Okay. And the map J flips up to down, as it were. And because it's antilinear, there's complex conjugation involved. If I change the phase of alpha AB with a e to the I phi, of course, in equation 11, it changes the phase of alpha BA by e to the minus I phi. And then when you tense the two together in the grand construction for the whole boundary surface, those two phase changes cancel. That's why it's a canonical choice of phase. Okay, any more questions on that construction?
So if you have a compact three-manifold, then by this gluing, there is not even a global phase left over, is it?
That's right. The global phase is now fixed. Yeah. Okay, and this is important for our asymptotics, of course, because you see, we had two problems. One is, what did we mean by an intertwiner when we scaled the k's? And we've solved that problem by using coherent states, because the coherent states are just specified by unit vectors. And of course, when you scale the k's up, the unit vectors don't change, so that's fine. We can specify a coherent state with a bunch of unit vectors, and then that will be sort of quotes the same coherent state, no matter how big the k's get. And the other problem we had, of course, was the phase was undetermined. And it's no good doing asymptotics if the phase just wanders all over the place as you increase k. So we need a coherent choice of the phase so we can do the asymptotics and get something sensible. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. My job is to explain this asymptotic formula. So I need to set the scene a bit about what's going on and what we're doing here in this formula. So let's talk back about the previous stuff. Previously I was talking about any closed three-manifold sigma. And in fact, this construction of the boundary state works for any closed three-manifold as long as it's orientable. But now we're interested in the nuts and bolts of the state sum model, so we're interested in the dynamics. So we're going to specialize to the particular case where we're looking at the boundary of a four simplex. So then we're just looking at the gluing together of the intertwining operators to make the four simplex amplitude. But we can think of this boundary of the four simplex as being one of these three-dimensional closed three manifolds with the boundary state on it. Okay, so in particular we have our in general an area geometry, and then we have special cases where we have the Reggie geometries, and then we have our conical choice of phase. So when we come to our asymptotic formula, what we're looking at here on the left, F4, this is the remind you now, this is the amplitude for the four simplex, which was determined back at the beginning of the talk by gluing together all these spin four intertwiners to form a closed spin network diagram. And On the right-hand side, what I've given you is the in a sense, the most important case of the asymptotics. There are a few other cases which I haven't put in here, but this is the sort of non-degenerate case, if you like. So this is the case when the boundary geometry, which goes into specifying the state on the boundary, namely the selection of the intertwining operators, and that boundary geometry is the Euclidean geometry of the boundary of a Euclidean four simplex. In other words, when it is a Reggie state, then we have this nice asymptotic formula, which I'll explain in a minute in equation 12. There are various other cases where the geometry doesn't form a nice Reggie state. And it seems that more or less generically, these are all exponentially damped. So the formula I'm about to talk about goes like lambda to the minus 12, where lambda is the scaling parameter. But all these non-Reggie geometries are generally killed exponentially in lambda. So when we go to asymptotics, they die very fast. There are some exceptional cases, which we call the single vector geometry, which aren't of the form I'm talking about here, but they seem to be just the boundary cases. They seem to be the case that equation 12, which I'll explain in a minute, holds most of the time. And on the edge of this, there are some exceptional cases, and then you're into the wilderness where there's no asymptotics, polynomial asymptotics at all. So I think this is the most important case to explain, so the generic case where the asymptotics is polynomial and not exponential. Okay, so let me try and explain what's in equation 12. So first of all, ignore the scribble and just look at the nice LaTeX. So lambda is our scaling parameter. We're scaling all the k parameters up by multiplying them by lambda. So we go like lambda to the minus 12. Then in the bracket we have constant terms, so the n's are independent of lambda. They depend on the emergency parameter and the geometry and so on, but they're independent of the scaling parameter. And then we're multiplied by cosines or exponentials, which are of course basically of unit magnitude. And so they're just basically telling us the phase information and the interference. And the quantity that appears everywhere is the sum over all triangles in the four simplex of KAB times theta AB. So KAB, these are the spin labels on the triangles, and theta AB is the dihedral angle for the four simplex geometry formed by the boundary data. So this sum of KAB, theta AB is of course nothing other than the Reggie calculus action for the boundary geometry. So it's rather fantastic that this formula is written entirely in terms of this Reggie action. Well, it seems fantastic when you work it out, but of course the whole point of these models were constructed to rather hope that this property would come out to be true. So perhaps it's not so fantastic after all. But it always seems that way when you do asymptotic calculations. But interestingly, the emergency parameter comes into the first term, the cosine term. We have cosine of lambda times gamma. And of course, lambda times k, so what I'm treating here is the k is a constant and lambda is the scaling. So lambda k, if you like, is the sort of the scaled k. So that's why lambda appears everywhere. It's a straightforward reason. But the appearance of the emergency parameter in the cosine is a rather interesting term, rather interesting fact. So this first term, the cosine, was the term we discovered first. So if you like, this is the Marseille term. So this is the term I talked about last November back in Marseille. For the simple reason we hadn't discovered the other two terms at that time. So this is very much, of course, like the Poincaré-Reggie formula in three dimensions, where you have an asymptotic formula for the 6J symbol in terms of the cosine of the three-dimensional Regikaka's action for a tetrahedron. So we got all excited about this, and it was only later when I came back from Marseille we found the other two terms to complete our formula. So the other two terms involve exponentials, but there's no Emiratzi parameter in the exponentials. So you have something like the Regi-Calculus action on its own, but without the Emiratzi parameter. So this is rather strange and weird and wonderful formula. I should explain a little bit about the proof of this formula and the sort of geometrical significance of the various terms. So let me explain a little bit about how the asymptotics goes. You see, we've got our boundary geometry, which is specified by these three-dimensional unit vectors on the tetrahedron. So we have n1 to n4 on each tetrahedron. And these specify the face normals for the triangles in three dimensions. Now, when you boot this up to four-dimensional geometry, the face normals become bivectors. So in the four-dimensional geometrical picture, you have a simple bivector for each two-dimensional triangle. So you can think now a simple bivector is one in which the self-dual part and the anti-self-dual part have the same magnitude. And so there's a very simple bivector. That's you have the three-vector n repeated, n, if you like. And that's the four-dimensional simple bivector for each triangle. Viewed as a three-dimensional object. And it turns out that what happens is that these simple bivectors are rotated in four dimensions, and then they all fit together nicely to make the four-dimensional geometry. So what we have here is the four-dimensional geometry, which is constructed by a sort of bivector construction. So we don't sort of directly get edge length for our four-dimensional simplex. What we do get is we get bivectors for each triangle, and the bivectors then turn out to be ones having the property that they come from the four-dimensional simplex. It's sort of a very indirect way to get the geometry. And it comes about, of course, because we only have data on two-dimensional and three-dimensional simplexes, so we can't have data that directly give you the edge length. We have data on the two-dimensional stuff, and then constraints on the three-dimensional stuff saying that they really all come from edge length. So it's a bit of a roundabout way. But that's how the geometry appears. So if we go, we think back to, indeed, flip back to the intertwiner diagram, we had an integral over dx plus and dx minus to turn the quantum tetrahedron intertwiner into an SO4 intertwiner. So what happens is that when you glue together all these three-dimensional quantum tetrahedra, they're glued together via a big spin networking diagram that involves integrating over these x plus and x minus variables in S2, or if you like, one variable in spin 4 for each tetrahedron. So it takes the three-dimensional quantum tetrahedron and then averages over it into four dimensions, with a sort of four-dimensional rotation, if you like. And the way we do the asymptotics is we look at this integral over all these four-dimensional rotations. So all these quantum tetrahedra are all sort of jiggling around in four dimensions. So what we do is we look for the stationary points in this big integral over all the x's, and then interpret these geometrically. This is where the bivectors come from. The bivectors are you start with the three-dimensional picture. You think of that trivially as sitting in four dimensions by just adding a fourth dimension, and the vectors become bivectors. And now you act with all those X matrices to make a fluctuating four-dimensional picture. So we naturally get these bivectors. So I can explain where the various terms come in for equation 12. You see, if you look at the Marseille term, the cosine, that's really the sum of two exponentials. And it turned out there's one exponential for bi vectors b minus and b plus on each triangle in the fourth simplex. And if you interchange the self-dual and anti-self-dual sectors, you get another sort of coherent solution, if you like, to all these stationary phase equations, b plus and b minus. And so the reason you get a cosine is you have some exponential for one solution, and you just have the complex conjugate of the exponential for the other solution. So they combine to give you this cosine. And it turns out the geometrical explanation for the b minus b plus is some four simplex geometry, and for b plus b minus it's the orientation reverse. If you have a parity operation which flips left-handed to right-handed things, then that interchanges anti-self-dual and self-dual bi vectors. So what we're seeing in the first term, in the Marseille term, is a load of four simplex geometries expressed through bivectors and their orientation reverses. And of course, you expect in quantum gravity, if you reverse the orientation of something, you get the complex conjugate of its amplitude. So that's why you get the cosine term. But then weirdly, the other terms come about because you can take, for the geometry, you can take the, given that we've got self-dual parts of bivectors and anti-self-dual parts of bivectors, you can take another solution where they're both the self-dual parts, b plus b plus. And that gives you the second term in equation 12. And you can also take a solution where you have for both the anti-self-dual parts, and that gives you the third term in equation 12. So it's very strange, the bivector picture, where you have... It seems that you get the proper bivector picture for the cosine term, but the other contributions to the asymptotic formula come from what seemingly looks like sort of something degenerate going on, where the bivectors, the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts, are both the same, and they're both equal to either the self-dual part of the nice term, if you like, the Marseille term, or they're both equal to the anti-self-dual part of the Marseille term. But so when we first found this, we thought, oh, they're some sort of degenerate contribution. But they're not. They're not degenerate. You can't get rid of them. They're part of the non-degenerate four simplex, sort of part of its bivector geometry, if you like. So they can't be sort of wished away.
Well, John, I have a remark there. With Florian, when we did our analysis for a general triangulation, so on one simplex it's hard to see whether they're degenerate or not. But what you see is that, in fact, they do correspond to a degenerate configuration. Essentially, associated to each four simplex, you can look at the normals to each tetrahedra embedded in four-dimensional space. Yeah. And you can look for the determinant of this object.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you will see that these contributions, that's what we showed, are essentially the contributions for which the determinants are equal to zero. So they do effectively correspond to... They are not degenerate from the three-dimensional point of view, but they are completely degenerate from the four-dimensional point of view. So if you want to get... What we showed is that if you exclude them, then you're sure to get the right asymptotic limit in a general triangulation. So it is shown there that they correspond to degenerate configuration.
Aha. Well, that's interesting. Well, in our picture, there is also a degenerate. There are also degenerate cases where the first term, the Marseille term, is absent, and you only get the second term and the third term. And that really does come from degenerate configuration.
But
in the non-degenerate case, you also get these contributions.
But I guess the subtlety is that there are two notions of degeneracy, and that's why it's confusing.
Yeah, you have to be very careful about what you mean by it.
One notion of degeneracy, the degeneracy you see from the three-dimensional point of view, looking at n and etc., only looking at the coherent state.
and the boundary. And that from this point of view, all the contributions which are written in your slides are non-degenerate.
That's right.
But now you can ask, okay, what is the meaning of this contribution from the four-dimensional point of view? So there's a notion of three-dimensional degeneracy and a notion of four-dimensional degeneracy. So what I'm saying is that there are not three-dimensional degenerate, but there are four-dimensional degenerate. That's the subtext.
Okay, thanks. So, moving on to the next slide. So, a more formal description of the method of proof. In fact, much of it is follows the lines of what we did in back in 1997 with the original model. The strategy is to write F4 as an integral using the coherent state. And then it's an integral over these x plus and x minus variables, one for each tetrahedron. We have a very large dimensional integral. So each x plus and x minus is three variables. So there's six variables for each tetrahedron. So there's 30 variables altogether. So you have a 30-dimensional integral. In fact, it obviously has six symmetries, overall symmetries, so it reduces to a 24-dimensional integral. And then what you see when you write this integral down is that it's of the form e to the lambda s. So in fact, if you think of the way the intertwiner is constructed, they're products of coherent states. And the coherent states we use have a very special property. That a coherent state in spin representation K is in fact the tensor product of 2K coherent states in spin half representation. So when you take all the inner products of all these intertwiners together, you can think of this as taking the inner product of lots of spin half coherent states. And then all that varies when you do the asymptotics is the number of these. So you have some inner product of one coherent state with another coherent state coming from a different tetrahedron somewhere, and it's to some power where the power depends on K. So it's just sort of a multiple of K. And then as you scale with lambda, you just see that you have something to the lambda K. In other words, you have a formula of the form e to the lambda s. That's a very important point. That's how we turn this into a doable calculation. So then, of course, you just simply run this integral through the stationary phase machinery as lambda goes to infinity. And of course, the asymptotics is dominated by the critical points. So the usual stationary phase, you have an imaginary S, and then you look for the stationary points of the action. Here, S is in fact complex. You have to be a little bit more careful there. And so not only does the imaginary part have to be stationary, but the real part has to be maximal, or whatever it's called. So when you look for those critical points with both conditions, that's when you get the geometry coming out of these bivectors. You have very specific configurations of these x variables, x plus and x minus, which combine together with the boundary data, the n1s to n4 for each tetrahedron, the x's rotate these ends, and they all click and fit together to form the very nice Reggie boundary geometry exactly at the critical point of this integral. But all the other points of the integral, of course, nothing happens. You don't get a special geometry. It doesn't fit together. It's not Reggie or anything. It's very much definitely just at the critical point. Of course, those are the important points. Those are the points that dominate the asymptotics. That's the whole point of the calculation. So we interpret the critical points as the four simplex geometry. So that was all the technology from 1997, essentially, just a little bit more complicated. But the new thing, the thing that's really new, is using this Reggie state condition to cancel or control the arbitrary phase in the boundary geometry. I think this regi-state condition is more general than the use we put to it here in this asymptotic. So I think you can use it to analyze more general three-dimensional boundaries in the state. Okay, so I'm more or less getting to the end here. So onto the last slide here, the outlook. There's various interesting special cases here you might look at. We've looked at them in the sense of substituting the particular values and said, oh, look. But I don't think anybody's done the serious work on these asymptotics yet. But for example, if you put the Mirzi parameter to zero, which is perhaps classically a strange value, if we just look at the formula, then of course the first term, the Marseille term, just becomes a constant, and we get two exponentials of the ordinary regi-calculus action. And so this is in a sense the simplest asymptotics, just involving one version of the regi action, and not the regi action and its also being scaled with the Mirzi parameter. The other thing you might look at is gamma goes to infinity, which of course classically you'd think of as having an action with a Hulse term, which involves 1 over gamma. So gamma goes to infinity, where you would sort of remove the Hulse term and get back to gravity without the Mirzi parameter. So if we stare at the asymptotic formula again, you might imagine that as gamma goes to infinity, that the Marseille term oscillates very rapidly, and then you can sort of neglect it for the usual reason. And then, of course, you get back to just two, again, two exponential terms with the regi action in it. So maybe that's related. Well, I don't see it in a technical sense, but maybe in a moral sense, related to the old asymptotic results we had back in 1997, or thereabouts, about the old 10J symbol. you see, if we take gamma to infinity, it essentially says that think of the J's, it says the J is getting large, but the K is sort of remaining finite. Well, yeah, who knows? Of course, in the old model, the K was strictly zero, which means the asymptotic doesn't work in the same way. Okay, so so that's a bit of a hand wave, but it's maybe interesting to think about some more. Of course, there are various other special cases. Gamma equals 1 is a special case, and our formula doesn't work for gamma equals 1, because gamma equals 1 is the topological model, the Aguri model. And in fact, the whole formalism doesn't reproduce that, so of course the asymptotics isn't going to. But certainly behavior in the neighborhood of gamma equals 1 is an interesting problem to look at. the numerical checks. Oh yes, and while I'm talking about gamma equals 1, of course, classically gamma equals 1 gives you something different. It doesn't just reduce the topological model. So there's something very interesting and fishy going on around gamma equals 1, which would be very interesting to look at. It seems that somehow the state sum model and the classical action and its quantization somehow diverge at that point. Yeah, so numerical checks. Obviously, we would like very much to do some numerical calculations, and efforts are underway to do such things, but of course they're rather difficult to get right. the original Ponsano Reggi paper had some numerical checks of their formula in it, so we'd very much like to have numerical checks of the formula here to make sure we're on the right track. But I'm hopeful that will happen in the not-too-distant future, in a matter of weeks or months, perhaps.
Okay, John, we only have about 10 minutes of bridge left, and
right.
There are a lot of questions as well, so it would be nice if you can...
Okay,
can
I'll wrap up. So certainly there's a very good question about the Lorentz inversion and simply substituting spin four for the Lorentz group, and that I believe work's underway on that. And finally, of course, one wants to know a sort of bigger picture and talk about gluing properties. What happens when you glue some of these together? It seems to have much better gluing properties than the old models 10 years ago. And so we can ask about Packner moves. Are there approximate Packner moves? Are there approximate Packner moves in some limiting case? If so, is there a renormalization flow, as Vincent-Rivasseau suggested to us back in Marseille in November? So that's a very interesting topic to ask. Is there some regime in which we can move to renormalization? Okay, so I'll wrap up there and see if anybody's got any questions.
So, questions?
Those who are not in the thin form details, I mean, the actual hard work, I think it would be very useful to know what the global picture is now. I mean, so at the moment, your asymptotics refers to F4. And so what does it tell us about the whole partition function Z? And where are we? I mean, I guess you assume that everybody knows about what Rajit thing looks like, whereas we don't. So you might want to tell us what the final global picture is. That's one question. The second question is that when you take this limit, asymptotic limit, it seems a bit strange to, again, those who are not experts, to just let this k's go to infinity or lambda, the spins go to infinity without doing some refinement. I mean, why does that look like a classical geometry? I mean, one might have thought that one really should have the simplex, which has, you know, more and smaller pieces, which are more like quantum mechanical. And where one should really need some refinement, and why is that not being done? And the last question is about, it would be nice if we can just have a very brief summary about how this relates to what Laura and other people had done some time ago about also looking at the classical limit. So that these are the three questions.
Right, okay, well, yeah, so your question, what's the bigger picture? Well, I sort of shied away from the bigger picture. But your second question is very much in that direction, so this is very much the start of the game, not the end point. Just looking at one four siblex on its own isn't a quantum gravity theory. So we would very much like to look at a situation where you can increase the k's by scaling and do some sort of refinement where we glue together more of these at the same time. And I think that's the calculation we'd very much like to be able to do, and to see in what regime you, if any, you get back to the stuff you recognize as classical physics. So I think, you see, and this is tied in with the question about the Packner moves and the renormalization and so on. So let me explain a bit. So if you have, so the idea is the Regi calculus is an approximation in a suitable regime to general relativity. You take the classical Einstein action and you essentially write the obvious extension of the Einstein action to metrics which are of Regi type, as I explained, which are given by simplexes which glue together in a good way, and then the statement is that the action is approximating the Einstein action. Now, of course, the Einstein action knows nothing about triangulation. So if you approximate the Einstein action, you will necessarily find that your approximations are approximately, to the same degree, of course, triangulation independent. So if there's a regime in which we recover general relativity, there's also the same regime in which we're recovering, to the same degree of approximation,
some sort of triangulation independence. And of course, if you have some sort of triangulation independence, then you've got the pattern of moves, which tell you, essentially on a small scale, when you clump together some simplexes in one particular way with a particular boundary, and you clump together some different simplexes with the same boundary, they tell you that you have triangulation independence if you can replace one by the other. So these very much look like sort of renormalization moves. Think of sort of naively of the block spin transformation. So that's an example of a Packner move. So you'd expect that if you're in some regime where you're getting close to general relativity, all these other things are happening as well. You're getting triangulation independence and some sort of renormalization with it, possibly. A more sophisticated version of triangulation independence. Because the thing that Vincent suggested particularly was that the Mirtzi parameter should run, be a running of the Mirtzi parameter. And so his suggestion was that this we're very much like the situation in non-commutative quantum field theory, where they formulate non-commutative field theory on non-commutative space-time, and find that you need an extra term that isn't in normal quantum field theory, called the Grosser-Volkenhaar model. And precisely there, what happens is there's an extra parameter, which they called omega, in fact. And all these people in this community, they always jump up at every talk and say, oh, your Mirtzi parameter is like our omega, blah, 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 blah. It should renormalize, it should run, blah, blah, blah. So that's a very interesting perspective, I think, something that people should be following.
More questions?
What is the relation between what you had done and what Laura and other people had done before?
That's a good question. So let me see. You're talking about asymptotics particularly?
Yes.
Yeah. So Laurent and Conradi were looking at a whole manifold and looking at the asymptotics in that context. And so essentially we're doing sort of something complementary, which is to look at the single force simplex. But I think possibly the two pictures are very much related. I expect they are. And particularly they saw this sort of Reggie states dominating type condition there. So that's what we see at this sort of micro level as well. I think possibly our extra thing that we've added is controlling this boundary phase. I mean, you know, I think that's something that's definitely new and wasn't in the previous work. So that's sort of enabling us to go local and to look at these properties in a local way.
Perhaps one last question.
Well, if not, I just want to ask if Laura has some comment on this.
On the relationship, I mean, the two things are totally, entirely in agreement. The difference is that what we do is, what we did with Florian, is to look at a general manifold. So our result is not only valid for one simplex or two simplex or three simplex, but an arbitrary number of simplex glued together. Now, in our analysis, in order to get this result, that we get the right classical limit, not only, I think there's an important point that not only you need one object, but you need to understand the gluing condition properly. So, but in order to get the right classical limit, we had to have an extra assumption, which was this non-degeneracy of the four-dimensional geometry. The thing which is new in John's work and collaborators is the fact that they have this much finer understanding of the phase and especially the contribution of the factor that I call the four-dimensional degenerate factor that we did not consider. So the thing, which was not depending on the Mirtzi parameter. By looking at one force simplex, you can really understand more properly these factors and also the pre-factors. So it's a very, it's complementary. Sometimes in one simplex, you can get a more detailed mathematical result, but you still have to worry about the gluing property, which is So we have developed techniques to, but the general philosophy, the key point in this whole analysis is the fact that the action is not a real action, but it's a complex action. And because it's a complex action, you don't get only one condition, which is usually too weak to get you the right semi classical. You get two conditions. One condition is the stationary of the imaginary part. But the other condition, which is a key one out of the semi classical, is the fact that you have to have the real part of the action to be to have a minimum. Instead of having one equation of motion, you get two. And that's where you get the whole power of the formalism. And it's tied up with the fact that behind this structure, there are beautiful structures, complex analysis, etc. Okay, I hope it answers the question.
Okay, I think we have to conclude because it's past 10:30. Okay. So let's thank the speaker again.
One more. Okay.
I think unless we are cut, if I cut off, we're cut off. But if you have another question, why don't you just ask it?
Okay.
I have a comment if there's some. This is Carla. Okay, so in fact, I have two comments. One is that the result of John and Winston and the others it's already been used for some papers already out, some papers which are on the point of coming out correct the previous result of the endpoint functions, what is called the propagator of the two-point function, and by a combination of people here, Alessi, Bianchi, Magliaro, Perini, and I hope I'm not forgetting anybody. So it seemed that using this result, there is now some much stronger results on the two-point functions that say that the what went wrong with the Barrett-Crane old version goes now correctly with this vertex. And so that's the first comment. Second comment related to that and to Abai's question about what is the meaning of taking large J and what Laurent also was saying about refining the triangulation. It seems to me, and I mean this is a long discussion which of course there's no time here, but it seems to me that all this is pointing out to the idea that there are different regimes which can be interesting and go to the classical regime, and the old intuition that somehow classical GR comes out from a lot of small Planck scale force impulses has to be revised. I mean, I think that the ensemble of this of these results say that there's something wrong in that intuition. In order to have a classical GR coming out, in some sense, one has to go to large spins, which, after all, is just standard quantum mechanics, large quantum numbers. So, my overall comment, I think, should be taken with respect to a Abai question. The point should be taken contrary. I mean, I don't think we should remain attached to the idea that macroscopic geometry is made by a lot of Planck scale tetrahedra, and that's the right way of viewing quantum gravitational microphysics.
Can I add something to go with Carlo on this point? Because I think it's a very important question that Abai asked, a very important point that we should convince people about. But this large spin expansion, if you think in terms of geometry, they look weird. But if you think in terms of curvature, what the curvature is, the curvature is inversely proportional to the spin. So in some sense, what these approximations amount to, it's an approximation where you have a low density of curvature. And this is exactly what you would what you would understand the semi-classical limit to be. So that's why in the spin foam, you're really trying to capture exactly the dynamics of the theory in this regime of low curvature. And if you think in that language, maybe it makes the limit more natural.
But does it mean that we just have nearly flat patches?
No, what it means, okay, so what it means is John was referring to that. What it means is that first you have to understand, so what it means is two things. First, you have to understand the boundary state. What we do is that we put spin networks on the boundary. So the spin networks on the boundary should be thought as boundary data, which are like almost locally flat. Okay. And then you know this result in continuum GR, that if you, let's say, put a boundary data which is piecewise near flat, then the exact continuous Hamilton-Jacobi action is the Regge action. So the Regge action is not an approximation of the continuum action. It is exactly the continuum action, but evaluated for particular boundary space. So what I think we are doing is that we are changing, instead of taking the graviton basis, we're working with spin network basis, which is a discrete basis. And in this basis, it turns out that the semi-classical limit amounts to a low curvature limit. And that's why, you know, this contribution arrives. Now, what you would like to do is maybe take the refinement limit of the boundary states, right? So, you know, we get, what we show is that we get the right semi-classical limit for a fixed boundary spin network. So if you give me a boundary spin network, you by choosing a boundary spin network state, you already selected some type of discrete geometry. Does that clarify?
Yeah, no, I think this is very plausible, but I think we're not completely dumb and stupid to think that one had to have a lot of little regions with the Planck scale. I mean, Planck scale geometry is really at some small scale, and you have to have this refinement. You have to have lots of these little regions put together to get macroscopic geometry. I mean, the picture that we have from this atomic physics or from... So I think there is a tension. I mean, I think I agree that...
Yeah, but the tension, you see, the tension is about the boundary state. So I totally agree with you in terms of boundary state. Now, if you tell me what I need to do is to get a boundary state which has zillions and zillions of you know, but this might depend on the question you want to ask. What we are doing is that if you give me a spin network state, right, and a fixed spin network state with a fixed number of valency, then I can compute the semi-classical limit for that state.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think what Carlo was saying perhaps was that we have to be more refined and make, and the answer might depend on the questions one asks.
Yes.
And for certain questions, the kind of thing that one is, you are saying, or Carlo and John are saying, which is that J is large, and so basically one is sort of saying that there is a large region in which curvature is basically constant. And then there's another region in which curvature is slightly different and so on. And you just patched up these regions in order to get a boundary manifold which is nearly flat. So for that, what you're saying is perfectly fine. But I'm not sure that that is the only interesting thing. I mean, I think you are agreeing with me.
I'm not saying this is the only interesting thing. But in fact, it goes back to something that maybe we should have done before, which is, what is the meaning of the spin network state? And what these results are showing is that they are giving the geometrical meaning of this state. And in fact, it might be an interesting question to go back to just pure analytical quantization. You see, this is really, the whole thing, this whole discretization and the bizarreness comes from the states we're choosing, which are the spin network states, that maybe we don't completely understand.
Yes, I think also in the context of quantum cosmology, these questions are interesting away from the singularity, because I mean, we have been focusing more on nearly singularity where the curvature is very large, fluctuating, etc. But if you went away from singularity, maybe the space-time looks approximately flat, and so therefore, or low curvature, and therefore these considerations might be important in the when the universe is large, so to say, low density, low curvature region.
So in some sense, I think it's maybe a good point for me to ask questions to people doing canonical analysis, because I think they, you know, it would be worthwhile to go back to the physical interpretation of this in network states and to see whether the canonical analysis, you know, does agree with what we are finding in spin form. That would be, you know, I think, yeah, this is a question that has not been completely resolved, I think.
Yeah, so I think an interesting point here is this finding that of the dominance of the Regge configuration. I mean, the question is, to what extent does that match with what you find from the quantum geometry picture?
Yeah, no, I think this is very interesting and very, very, I mean, I think I agree with everything that is being said, so we should really think in terms of quantum geometry along these lines and see if, in fact, we are in harmony or there is tension.
Right, right. Can I inject something here, this Galligan? I would say that on the one hand, one should not take the many small little things to picture too seriously. On the opposite hand, I don't believe that discretization should be taken too seriously physically as a picture where things are flat inside the tetrahedral, inside the four simplices. I think this is the opposite mistake. One thing is to use this flatness to say something about the mathematics, about the relations between discrete quantities. But say it is flat, it seems to me is the same mistake that one does. If I take a scalar field, I discretize it. I use the language of saying, well, I discretize it by assuming that the scalar field is constant between the points of the discretization. But that's not what I mean. What I mean is that I'm discarding degrees of freedom, frequencies which are higher than that. And the theory we're doing doesn't have certain degrees of freedom because they're cut off at the Planck scale or they're cut off in some appropriate sense. So if in the quantum theory, in some computing, some transition amplitude, we are using a certain discretization that looks like a regular geometry, it seems to me we are describing a theory which doesn't have certain degrees of freedom, and we're picturing those degrees of freedom as just putting flat things inside, but there's nothing flat there. So we have to find the intermediate physical picture between these two extremes, which seems to be both wrong to me. On the one hand, a lot of flat things glued to one another, which has to be a way of talking, not a physical picture of reality. And on the other hand, just Planck scale things glued together. I think that if you think quantum mechanically and not classically, there is an intermediate point between the two. When we say that the energy of an oscillator is quantized, we don't mean that the energy is zero in between or that the energy is flat between one eigenstate and the other. We only mean that it only can take those values. So it makes no sense to ask what is the geometry in the middle of one of the tetrahedra of the discretization, seems to me. When we're using a tetrahedron when we use a spin network, we are saying that the only data we have about the geometry are discrete, not that there are more refined data of the geometry such that it looks flat in between. I'm just a bit confused. I'm not offering an
answer. No, I think what you're saying is exactly the kind of picture that also arises in quantum cosmology.
That's
somehow
right.
There's a competition between the two things. Between the values of J's that one is using and the number of vertices is like or refinement. And I think there is a competition between the two, and one we are struggling to understand how the both things are needed, and the question is to what extent. But what you said just now, I completely agree that it's not really flat, but there's some kind of an averaging that is going on. Certain degrees of freedom, which really corresponds to higher frequency modes, not even Planck frequency, but just higher frequency modes here, just nearly flat geometries. And then the question is really that if you want to consider, full quantum gravity, then these modes are turned off, but that may be turned off at Planck scale and not at some higher scale. And therefore, the current work is really an approximation in which one is restricting one's attention to the cases where the boundary states happen to be extremely tame. But that is not kind of full. I mean, it's an important part of quantum gravity because that's what we need for classical regime. But it's certainly not, in some sense, the most interesting part, right? I mean,
well, no, because the approximations are good because they're approximation and they're valid in regimes. So the question is not whether this approximation is good or not. The question is in which regime this is a good approximation.
Yes.
And the the right question is there a regime where this is good?
I agree, but I think...
There's also, I would say, the fact that, you know, we have overlooked that we work with spin network states, and we are used to think of physics or gravity in terms of geometry, and spin network states are not exactly geometry, and this mismatch of what does it mean to look at the semi-classical limit of, you know, something having a spin network state on the boundary, there's something purely classical there that we don't understand, that we have overlooked, that we should go back to the original interpretation, which is what Carlo was saying. You know, what is the meaning of a classical spin network state? Is it something where we average over, where we neglect something, where we... These questions have answers, and they are independent of the quantum theory in some sense. So,
but I'd like to make a comment. There is a situation in which we know that small spins and many links dominate, which is the black hole entropy calculation, for instance. I mean, I just wanted to make that remark. So there are situations where semi-classicality comes with lots of small spin contribution.
Maybe, but it has to be understood in a dynamical framework.
I think it's more precisely, I think we sort of have to enlarge our vision, namely, for each set of physical questions, there may be different configurations which dominate and are important, and we should not sort of try to build everything from the same microscopic picture or from the same, you know, nearly flat picture, but rather really look at the theory more and more physically. And I think the fact that we are being forced to think in this direction is extremely encouraging, I think.
That's right. Black holes is precisely a case in which we know that high frequencies affect the microscopic thermodynamics somehow. So those
right.
are the ones that those are the ones that should count. That's right. So, but I think that what we have is a theory, and it looks remarkably good from a number of different directions. And the question is not from which direction it's the right way of viewing it. The question is, does this give good approximation in different regimes, and how to think about it in different regimes, seems to me. My optimistic view, hope, is that the small number of simple approximation could be good because of diffeomorphic invariance, in the sense in which Feynman diagram expansion is good. Quantum field theory is an infinite number of particles, but then when we use it, we go at approximation for a small number of particles. And in fact, the approximation for a small number of particles works very good at CERN, order by order. We know that it's an approximation, particles are infinite, but we do Feynman diagrams up to three particles. And it's a dramatic cutoff of the degrees of freedom. All the infinite particles are not there, and it works well. So I'm not able to defend this picture all the way through for quantum gravity, but my hope is that we need an expansion to do calculations. If we don't have an expansion, we're not able to do calculations.
Right.
And the small number of simple expansion is an expansion. It's one of a few hopes we have to do calculations, which of the kind of scattering or things like that. Now, of course, then there's a question of the normalization and how the infinite degrees of freedom affect the few ones and all that. But it's a possible handle on the theory, and that's for me the reason of exploring the small number of simplest approximations.
Okay, I think if John Barrett has any last remarks, he should have the last word.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. It's been a pleasure to talk to everybody and hear all the comments. And I don't think I've got anything else scientifically to say, but it's been a very interesting conversation.
Okay, let's thank John again.